Hello and welcome to another episode of Flip the Focus. I am Jen Dobby and I'm the creative director at Hotwa Australia. I am also a tech sticky beak and teller of female tech stories. Now on the podcast today, I'm so excited to have Nicole Cook with us. Nicole is a true leader in Australian tech funding. She's spent the last 20 years really working at that very high systemic level to understand the landscape in Australia. And once she'd had that experience, she's really been working on changing it for the better for female tech funding. So she was an essential person for me to have on when we got into Flip the Focus. Welcome to the podcast, Nicole.
Oh, thanks, Jen. I love the work you're doing, and I'm really so happy to be part of this discussion. Having listened to many of your previous episodes, I just love the focus. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you so much. Nicole, let's get into what you're doing at the moment. So you've started a relatively new role at SBE Advisory. Can you start by just telling us very simply, what is SBE Advisory? What does it do and how does it work?
So we've been working with women founders for a very long time. When we looked at the strategy in 2022 of what we really had in terms of an impact, we realized that we were impacting individuals, but we weren't actually changing the landscape, and we needed to do a bit more of that. So we launched SBE Advisory, which is a consultancy to help women who are growing big businesses scale. The advisory is really here to help women-led businesses scale globally and do really big things. We want to back women doing really big things with tech and other industries and growing really big businesses. That's what we want to do with the advisory.
That's such an amazing role. And one of the things I love about you doing the research for this is how you've always operated at that slightly higher level in terms of overlooking the landscape. So you used to be lead Jobs New South Wales. I think what was incredible during your tenure in that role was really setting up the Sydney Startup Hub and also AgTech in the cluster that we have in Armidale. It'd be really good for you to explain to us kind of the impact and the contribution that they made to New South Wales specifically, really accelerating to be positioned as a global leader in tech.
Yeah, so when those ecosystems, and they're referred to as precincts in Australia, for anybody internationally listening to that, that's, you know, kind of, you know, more of a jail in other
okay,
countries.
Okay, so maybe not that.
At least being American, it's kind of, you know, you say a precinct is more of a jail, but they're referred to and they have been as precincts, and there are many ecosystems that kind of foster, innovation. And, you know, New South Wales kind of leading the way by activating through the Sydney Startup Hub and now through the Tech Hub and the Tech Central, there's a new name since I've left, is really about creating those communities and, activating that real ecosystem of support for, you know, entrepreneurship. And Victoria has done the same thing. LaunchVic has been amazing, along with a number of other organizations in Victoria. I think Startup Vic has now changed its name to have a national focus. You've got areas in Queensland, you know, that are doing the same. And governments are really backing this. And so in South Australia, there's activity, and in WA, there's activity. So it really kind of ignited the ecosystem for tech.
So can you break that down a bit for us in really basic terms? How is commerciality measured within the Australian economy and how does tech contribute to that?
So economies are measured in contribution, different metrics. But one of the things that is actually really interesting, particularly to me, is the Economic Complexity Index, which is, you know, an index that's come out of Harvard through the Growth Lab. And I find it fascinating because it measures basically measures the cool stuff you're doing and who in the world's using it. You know, what are you producing that's really, really cool and exporting? And then there's the subset of that, which is measured under a different organization, which is the Innovation Index, which measures how much you're actually commercializing that cool stuff and how much you're generating, right? Again, it's a lot more complex than that, but trying to keep it in very simple terms, you know, And so the importance of doing that, you know, is significant. So Australia on that index, just so you know, and for context, has dropped 38 places, 30 years, it's dropping. So we're currently sitting at 93rd out of 133 countries on that index, which is next to Uganda and Pakistan. One of the most educated countries with probably a significant level of GDP for the population. So you go, why is that? You know, what is that? What is that about really, right? And so you think about it and you say, well, economic complexity, everyone knows this is a mining country, right? You know, we export very well and we've done that for years, but are we really comfortable there? I love this country. I moved here 18 years ago and I think the lifestyle, what you get, you know, the quality of education is phenomenal. The issue and the concern I have is what jobs are going to be in the future and what jobs will people do and are we building the right talent to do those jobs? And if they're not here, what does the country become, right?
Exactly. And am I right in thinking that at this point, tech is the seventh largest contributor there or thereabouts as a sector?
I believe so, yeah. And, you know, and so what do we need to do about that, right? And this, I'll get to the women's kind of why I'm backing women.
Right, because, you know, the Sam Mustin report from the end of last year tells us we've got $128 billion gap for women's participation. So to me, if you put together tech being such a significant part of that opportunity and $128 billion, it's a massive gap, but it's also a massive opportunity. So, you know, how are we getting into that?
So I see it as a massive opportunity. So quickly, the innovation index is 24. Now, that's not bad out of 132, but it stayed there for like the past 10 years. Like it's stagnant. So it's great, but it's stagnant. So what do we do about it? So we can't shift it with half the population. Like you can't shift it with half the population. You got to get the other half participating and you got to get a lot of diverse groups participating. You get all genders participating, right? And so what do you do to get all genders participating at that level, and particularly in tech? How do you get women doing more cool stuff and growing it really, really big and helping shift that index? Yeah, we've set our goal of a 10-year window. And our mission in the advisory is to get more brave women driving really big businesses and multiplying that. So getting brave women taking on big challenges, amplifying them through growth, and then multiplying the number of them.
So then the conversation around that becomes, okay, that is, you know, brave women taking on big challenges and then scaling them. The conversation about that is, how do we feed into that, right? Where are those women coming from? How are we encouraging them? And then it becomes a systemic and structural conversation, right? And when I said at the top that you think about things from that really high level, that's what I mean. Like, that's the level that you're operating at.
And that's the level that we're operating at. But I think having grown up in emerging tech, accidentally, by the way, because I was a French international business major, but you know, thank God American companies took everyone and just trained you how to code.
Well, tell us about that. So, did you come into scale ups from a coding background?
Yeah, so I wasn't a very good coder, but I graduated in a recession, so with a French international business degree, right? And so, long story short, the American companies at the time would take all students from any background, which again, Australian businesses don't do, and they don't do well. They choose you very specific to your degree, but American companies used to take very, you know, if you prove you were smart, they would just grab you into these cohorts and throw you all in centers in Chicago and teach you all how to code out of university. So it wasn't a university degree, it was out of the university.
But certainly answers one of those questions around in Australia, how do you start
It's actually the corporate's responsibility to start doing square pegs instead of round peg, round hole. Like, basically they taught us all how to code, and then you got in with people who knew it. And my experience, you know, was always 50-50. Like, I reported to two women. I mean, and that's like, I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but that's a long time ago.
And the partners, I mean, it's rare even now, being involved in coding and report. That's hugely rare.
Well, it wasn't then. It was just normal. Like, it was 50-50. Partners were women. Like, it was, sorry, it was like 30 years ago. So this is the issue that I have coming here. And again, it's because I grew up in Boston. So if I grew up somewhere else, or if I grew up in California, probably would have been the same. But I grew up in Boston. And so we went into tech and we were coding, and it was 50-50. It was women, men. I reported to men. I reported to women. I learned, you know.
But I love that you've had that experience. So you haven't brought with you any kind of baked in bias that it's going to be a certain way. You know, in your first role and your even training before your first role, you were like, oh, okay, so it's men and women. Great. So that's just the way it works in tech.
Just
great.
The way it worked.
Yeah.
Even the cohorts for training, like, we weren't under any diversity metric or anything, but the cohorts were men and women. Like, they were young men and women. It was just was. There was no diversity metrics. It was just was. So when I, anyway, so I ended up with a tech background. Like I said, I wasn't a very good coder. I was better at QA and testing, and I was better at the product. Like,
so
product,
the broader systems thinking, and then product market.
Yeah, I was better at the product. I was better at taking that to market. I was better at solving problems. I mean, I could code. I just, you know, not sure I was that good at it. My former colleagues might laugh when I say that. But, you know, who are still quite good friends of mine, which I will share in a second, because my friends are all senior women in tech in the US now. So they're all CIOs, CTOs running tech, like tech. They're in tech roles. That's because that's who I knew.
That's so interesting, though, to see that, you know, Boston being a university town and having that sense of movement and momentum. And, you know, it's borne out. Those women that you were working alongside and learning alongside have, you know, having long careers in tech. And that's exactly what we need to replicate here, right?
Right. So fast forward, consulting, internet boom. I ended up in a startup with all of them, same people. So that was a long time ago, and, you know, kind of grew in these businesses. And then I got here and tried to find something similar, and I went, oh my God, this economy is so boring. Where is everybody? So it was boring, and none of the women worked, and it was just where I landed. You know, there was no, I was like, where am I? And so it was just so foreign. Now, I ignored that for a long time, because I ended up joining a startup that was run and founded by a woman. She's amazing. She's overseas. She hates when I mention her name. So she's on her fifth business, and it's turning over $1 billion in the US, and she's Australian. But those women didn't necessarily talk about it. They just kind of did it, right? And so when I got here, I worked for a company that grew and got sold and was international in 12 years, and it was run by two women.
Well, let's talk to that now. So let's ask the question, what do you think that some of the current barriers are in Australia to women taking on that challenge of tech role?
So there's generational change. You can't be what you can't see, right? You can't be what your parents aren't talking about. You can't be what's not in the house. You can't, you know, unless you step out and you see it on your own, you know, which is the unique person that steps out of what they've been guided towards to do something totally different. You know, that's not the norm. The norm is that you kind of are guided by whatever environment you're brought up in. So if you're brought up in, you know, in the major cities and in the education systems where you're either single sex or you're, you know, making choices on your, you know, college entrance based on what's easy or what's going to get you a higher score versus what might challenge you. And that's the structures all the way through to employment. So let me be very clear that what you choose in high school in Australia is how you get into university. And unless you change that and decide to change that, then you go into your career. And the companies are trained to look at that journey. Very linear, right? And so recruiters are trained to look at that journey. No matter how hard they try to change the manager's mindset, they don't, because they came up in those structures too. So round peg, round hole, right? So, for example, you go to a single-sex private school, public school in Sydney, you are female, you are male. You choose economics and finance at the boys' school. My son did go to all boys, and graduating class was business at Sydney Uni. And so no tech. Like, I think it's shifting and I think it's becoming engineering, but there was no, I'm going, come on. And then you go to this beautiful all single sex women's school in North Sydney again. And again, I'm generalizing the experience, but this is just to make the point. And you go through and you're getting ready for your ATAR, and the women need to do 99.95. And when they get to 99.95, they might have chosen the courses that are going to get them that score rather than the hard one. Like, maybe they didn't choose chemistry, or maybe they did, but the majority are not choosing chemistry or science or whatever, or tech, for God's sake. They're not even doing tech. They're not even like graduating with tech. Like, they might get an entrepreneurship class, but they're not graduating. They've never coded. You know, they did something else in tech. They've never coded. And then, you know, both graduate, and then, you know, a lot of them go into medicine and law. I'm totally generalizing, but this is just to make the point, right? And so you go into medicine and law because you've done really well. Very few in either of those camps are going into tech, right? And very few women, from what I observed, are going into tech because it's not brought up through there. You go into university courses, and then that perpetuates. You go into the jobs, and that perpetuates. And that's, you know, men in investment and women in, you know, different, like, I'm going to just stay with business because that's what I know, and HR marketing, right? And so you're going, where in those structures do you change things? And then we get to our stage, and we're saying, okay, we need to have diversity metrics and women and this and that, and women need to be doing this, and we need to change structures, when in fact it started a long time ago. So, you know, I think there's a lot of places where the co-ed education is working, and we have a lot of resources here to do it. We actually have such an educated population to do it. So if there are women on this journey, we want to help them get there faster, you know, and through expertise. I think one thing I can say about, you know, 90% of our advisors have done this. Everyone who's working with us as an advisor in the advisory has built a business.
Let's talk a little bit about that advisory and that experience. You've talked to, you know, this goal of really supporting women particularly to do more brave things and building that support network around them. So we've talked structurally and systemically what that looks like. And I guess the other side of where your experience comes in is financially. What does that look like? How does that support system work if we're going to really scale businesses at pace?
Yeah. So, you know, a business journey is multifaceted, right? So you have the idea and you've got to grow it, and then you've got to become a company. So in other words, you've got the product. Now you've got to figure out how to build the company around that product, bring it to scale, take it to market, and then take it to multiple markets, right? So when you hit your first million, that's a tough journey. When you hit your first 10 million, that's a different journey. 1 million to 10 million is a very different journey. Revenues. Sorry, I'm talking about revenues. So then you go 10 million to 50 million. That's a different journey. And then 50 to 100, and then 100 to a billion, right? So every single stage of that journey is different and hard and filled with different people and fun. Once you do it once, unfortunately, you're addicted. So once you do it once, it's very hard to go back to it. Yeah, you kind of get a bit addicted to it. So so what do you need from, you know, and there's a lot of organizations in Australia, which is excellent, that focus on the ideation through to the first million. You see that in all the numbers. It's coming through in terms of the number of women getting funded at the early stages. There's a lot of early stage stuff that's out there to get you started. And then what? You know, women getting funded, the numbers are changing, which is good. After lots of conversations, the numbers are starting to change on the early side of the pipeline. When you go from 500K to your first million, and then 1 million to 5 million, that's really where the rubber meets the road. Is this going to work? Like, is this going to work? What experience do I have in making that work? what do I bring to the table? Like from a founder perspective, that's what they're thinking. Like, how am I going to do this? And so what the advisory is meant to do is work with them in those growth stages. Like, what decisions are you making? How do your numbers factor into that? Like, how do you optimize your cash runway to do what you're doing before asking investment, so that you're not like, you don't hit a state of desperation where you only need capital to survive? How do you learn to manage the pressure of a weak financial position while you're doing something you absolutely love? Like, how do you do that? Right. And so that's like the one to 1.5 million revenue, 5 million. And if you do it well, you have an opportunity to get funded, right? Because your numbers are right, your metrics are right, you're proving it, you've got customers, you've got growth. We'll get to the challenges around that. But if you're kind of doing it and proving it out and the metrics are showing and you're managing your money and you're managing your numbers, there is a better opportunity to get funded. I'm not saying you will, but I'm just saying a better opportunity. And then 5 to 10, in Australia, a lot of companies tap out at 20 million in revenue, size market, right? So you're going 5 to 10 million, you're doing teams, all of a sudden you got to do HR stuff and you got people and culture issues and you're becoming a company. You're not quite there yet. You don't know how many people you need. You might've taken funding that you're not sure how to, you said you would spend it this way, but now you have to spend it that way. And so those journeys are hard. Then you start hitting your 10 million and how you're going to grow. What's my option? What's next? Like, in this market, what's next? I've got to go international. I've got to.
Yeah. I think to talk to that 5 to 10 million, that's often where in my role, we start interacting that kind of post round A, because we did some research with the University of Sydney Business School, which really highlighted the pivotal tipping moment where you can kind of get away with not thinking too hard about brand and messaging, because really you're concentrating on product market fit and you don't have, you know, the time or the money to really be thinking in that space.
Right.
But once you get past that, you've achieved your product market fit, you must scale and you must build a cohesive community around you to help you do that. And you must start thinking about loyalty and nurturing and customer life cycles and churn. And that's the exact moment at which, you know, particularly within the Australian market, we found that a lot of the branding conversations around building a brand and scaling it alongside the product weren't happening. And so it contributes to that journey slowing down. People have this amazing momentum and the lift, and then they're not building a brand. So they're not getting brand awareness and recall and intention to attract and all those good things that in the longer term will help them raise those types of funds and help them scale internationally as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because you have to, in order to raise the funds, you have to show growth, right? And so in order to show growth, you have to show traction. And if you haven't had traction in the past 12 months, then obviously they're asking why. And then they need the funds to be able to engage organizations like yours to be able to help them kind of unlock that growth, right? So that's kind of where we are hoping to step in. And so then we can introduce them, like we can help identify that as an issue, introduce them to your organization and work with a lot of other partners to be able to do what we want to do to help them. Again, our goal is to get them more women doing it and at scale and ideally at pace so that we can have them, you know, a lot of them getting from that early stage pipe up through to the bigger growth companies.
And that's what I find so interesting, Nicole, that I hadn't really realized is that, or that you just spoke to, there is a relatively concrete number on the ceiling for which people tend to make it. Did you say it's about 20 million revenue?
I use 20 million as a guide. Other people might not, but like you can, you basically, you know, maybe not in cyber, maybe not in climate, maybe not in, you know, well, locally, you're going to hit a cap in the market just because of the size of the market. It has nothing to do with anything else other than the size of the market. You're going to hit a revenue cap. Whatever that revenue cap is for your industry, if you want to go beyond it, you have to go offshore. Whereas American companies don't. Like, they can stay right there happy as anything and make huge amounts of money. Australian companies, you know, I say a good majority of them, if they want to tip over that $20 million revenues mark, again, that benchmark is going to be different for different industries, like, you know, that have opportunity. But as a whole, you know, speaking more business tech, 20 million is the mark. Like, that's going to be it. And now many people are very happy exiting at that.
And so the conversation I want to have with you now is what happens after that, right? So let's say you're building this pipeline. We're working in this dream scenario. Let's say we're 5 years down the road. We've started getting less silo thinking between education and business. We're getting the pipeline in. People are getting to 20 million. What happens post that? How do you support them? What's the function and the system around them, particularly with the three new organizations of which SBE is really an integral part?
Right. So the companies want them. There's no doubt, but we need them choosing that as a career. We need them choosing tech as a career. We need them choosing to commercialize the science as a doctor. To say, I've done this really cool thing. I want to take it to market. What does that mean? How do I create IP off of it? So if you are a doctor, commercialize your research, commercialize your IP, step out of the research bubble and take it to market and figure out how to do that. We need more women doing that. So if we need more women in those roles and we need more women in investment, making the investment decisions, we need more capital. So right now you can say, oh, this VC is not investing in women, or this VC is not investing in women, or so on and so on. Well, I think that if you have more capital and you have, oh, one of the things that I forgot to say about economic complexity, and Minister Husic said it, is in order to fix it, we got to take some big bets. We got to take some strategic bets, right? And again, culturally, Australia is a bit risk averse, but taking big bets is the thing everywhere, like women on their careers, and then those that are putting capital into funds. So I'm going to the LPs, the ones that put money in funds. So the deployment of the capital is one thing, but where is that capital coming from is another. So then you've got the fund, and the fund has raised money from these people, right? And in that fund, who's making the decisions to deploy the capital? Right? Who's making the decision that you've just presented your business case? You've done a great job. You're 1 to 5 million, and your, you know, business is a tech business and it has certain metrics. Who's making the decision on whether or not you get funding from my fund? Who are they? Right?
And at this point, I'm going to guess that they're largely male.
And the men have good intention. They're not
largely.
Largely, they have good intention. They're not intentionally saying, I'm not going to invest in that. They have metrics they're looking at, and those are the growth metrics, right? And they have a thesis that they're following. And in reality, a lot of funds only do 10 to 12 investments a year. We want women ready and their businesses hitting every target and that metric when they go for the capital. Focus on growth. So when they go for the money, we want them to be ready. So that's the first mission of the advisory. The second side of it is, how do we get more capital? Just more capital. So we're all going to the same people, the same investors, the same. How do we get more capital? How do we get more funds? And then therefore funds with people making decisions that understand these businesses differently, and they can put money. So women-led funds, women-led investors, more, and, you know, just more funds available in, you know, tech, biotech, direct-to-consumer tech, like more funds. And so how do you do that? So we'll have a role in that as well. And how do we get investors? And this is very interesting for Australia. Very few like to lead a deal. How do we get somebody in a leading position for women who are very confident in leading the deal? Because it's really crucial. You can't get funding if no one leads. So now I'm going to bring it together with the capital and with the advisory. What we're hoping is that for those that want to back our mission of getting more women doing big things, if the deal's not perfect and there's something that is concerning about the growth, that they partner with us as part of the deal to progress it. So for example, if they put forward funding a global expansion strategy into the US, right? But the investor is not confident that they actually are able to do that. They might say, we want you to work with the advisory to get you landed and expanded into the US. And based on that, we'll give you the investment.
Okay. So you set them up for success in terms of having everything. They come to you with the business hitting all the marks, but you set them up for success in terms of how to have that conversation, how to make sure you've got everything that you need, the structure, the community. Wow. And the network, presumably, as well, to have those conversations.
Exactly. So that's the goal. Or they say, listen, we like these metrics, but this one's a bit weak. You're a bit stagnant on growth. However, we like the vision that you have. Can you work with the advisory to make sure that you execute well on that?
So let me ask you the question. If we have people listening to this who think, this is amazing, you know, this is where I want to set my hat at for the next year, or this is what I'm coming up to already, how do they get in touch? What's the best way to get involved with the SBE advisory?
So the best way right now is through our website. We've got some exciting stuff coming up that'll be very different approach to how you work together as a cohort to unlock that growth. And then if your investor is saying, listen, I've got some great women in my pipeline who are kind of stuck, you know, they can refer into the advisory. And then also if their investor is saying, I've got some deals that I really like, but these are the areas that I'm concerned about, then they can also get in touch with the advisory. So that's different ways that they can get in touch. But you can see that by putting the networks around it with the not-for-profit, the really bespoke growth advisory work with the funding, we feel and that we can get more women doing really big things.
Yeah, I think it's an extraordinary offering, and it feels like it's coming at exactly the right moment of momentum as well, particularly for female founders. Yeah. We ask each of our guests on Flip the Focus the same three questions. And the reason that we do that towards the end of the conversation is we want to make sure that everybody who listens to this walks away really well informed, but also with actions that they can take to help amplify women's voices in tech. So the first of those three questions, Nicole, is what advice would you give for a woman who is looking at getting into tech in Australia now? From your experience, what would your advice be?
I've got two pieces of advice depending on where you're at. If you're sitting in a corporate role thinking this is really cool, I've got to figure out how to get involved and upskill myself, get in touch with organizations like ours and others, get familiar with what's out there, and start the conversation, join some of the networking events, and also take a course. Like, there's some really cool stuff right now coming out of Stanford, coming out of Harvard, you know, upskilling on AI and just the emerging tech and what's coming. And then the second one, if you're a parent and you're saying, and you're listening to this and you're watching, you've got young women at home and you're saying, how do I get them to know that this is an option, is start talking to them about what some of the amazing women in tech are doing in Australia. Create the environment where they know that this is a future, and that this becomes cool in your house. And the more that we can do that as a parent and with our kids, the cooler it's going to become.
Yeah, I think so. And it makes sense to me. I think that's an amazing piece of advice. Looking at tech, there are so many more things that it offers aside from just the career, like the work-life balance and, you know, really lots of international travel, for example, and working with lots of different diverse types of people who are attracted to that environment. I think it has so much to give. So our next question is, if you did have a magic wand and you could either disappear or really elevate any element of the tech experience for women at the moment, what would you do? What would you pick and why?
I think on this question is that it's just normal that this conversation somewhat goes away, right? That it just becomes the normal course of business and life and interactions, and that this conversation is meant to bring awareness. And a lot of those that are taking positions on changing structures is meant to create a way to remove obvious structural barriers. That's what I would hope for. So we're so good at talking about things. I looked up the first time that they presented the stats on women CEOs in Australia, and it was 1998. I'm not sure there was an opportunity for it to be on the web any earlier than that. Right? So you go, we have had the same stats and talking about it since 1998.
And you've always been more likely to be called Peter or John than to be a female CEO in Australia.
Exactly. And we've been talking about that for so long, talking about it, creating metrics. So the goal that we have, or that I have with this, is creating women CEOs through these emerging tech businesses, that conversation just goes away. It just is.
I do love that perspective, because I think for so many of us involved in the conversations around, you know, any form of equalization or equity conversation, that really it shouldn't be necessary anymore. That's kind of the whole goal of it, right?
Right. So if we're talking about it in 10 more years, shame on us.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Shame on us. Our last question that we ask is, what can our listeners do now, today? A couple of really tiny actions that could be as small as following a particular person on LinkedIn, that you would say, look, you know, while you've got your phone out and you're listening to this, just do this.
If you meet a woman that is starting a business or growing a business, ask her what she needs.
It's very powerful. And I think those conversations, you know, even through the course of this podcast series, we've learned so much that just by having those conversations with people, what stage are you at? What do you need? It's so often that myself or the other person involved will say, oh, I know so-and-so at such and such. They can help with that. I'll put you in touch with that. And it's networking, but really elevated. Rather than asking people where they want to go or what they want to achieve, it's what do you need right now?
And that's why the advisory is focusing where we are. The capital conversation is being run and discussed by the VCs, but every entrepreneur I speak to says, how am I going to get funded? So we work with them to say, well, what happens if you don't? And how are you going to get through it anyway? Are you going to do it anyway? What have you got? What's the grit? What's the level? What's your commitment? How are you going to get it there? And then when you get low on capital, what are you going to do? And so we help them make those really hard decisions, not to say that they won't ever get capital, but we just kind of retrain the thinking that you're in this to grow this business. And the capital comes when you're doing something really good and people back it.
And again, it's that longer term thinking, isn't it? Because we spoke earlier about all different kinds of restrictive thinking. And don't just think about the next goalpost, which is the funding, because that's such a small thought process. It's all of that. What do we do if we do get funding? How do we scale that?
The most important thing we're going to do is work on the fact that they're going to grow these businesses, and they're going to figure out what to do when they have 20 employees, 100 employees, 150 employees. And that's where the experience from the advisors and the group that we have is really shines, because that's what we're going to bring to the table. And having all of us having been through it before at various levels of securing capital, but we've all been in it and grown big businesses.
And it's such an interesting You know, that's such an interesting and important part of your vision to have, because you think if you're successful in that pursuit, you can help to mitigate the situation which tech is so well known for, you know, the massive hiring blitzes and then the mass redundancies and that huge roller coaster, and really help to train people to think from the beginning how to scale responsibly, but also at pace.
At pace. One of my favorite lessons that I've been sharing with a lot of the founders that I work with, and I, particularly when they're struggling or trying to get capital, is that I was part of a business that was funded at $45 million. That's when tech was expensive. So the funding rounds were huge. We grew to 150 developers, you know, as part of the leadership team. And we were burning money left and right. We had somewhat of an irresponsible founder with the cash. And we had to prepare the business for the next stage. We had about maybe 80 to 100 developers. We looked at who was the most productive, kept five. And they carried the business forward. I think those still five or six are still working together today. But it was one of my biggest lessons learned ever. And so when we bring that to the table, working with the founders, it's quite interesting when we actually have to unpack how to optimize their cash flow because they actually haven't yet secured the funding. And it's, you know, once they understand it, it's kind of an interesting lesson.
It's a very profound lesson. And I think it's a really important thing that you bring to the table, and also to be open in having that conversation. I'm not talking theoretically, I'm talking literally. I've had this experience. It is not okay. It is not fun for anybody involved. And we need to learn how to build businesses that don't need to do this.
Yeah. And if you build it from the beginning responsibly, then you don't actually have to, you may not get to that stage where you have that drastic of a decision to make. But it's how you can extend your cash runway and figure out how to get really good people. And, you know, yeah, you know, it's one of my favorite things to actually do with founders and businesses. I love it. Optimizing your workforce to delivery at high productivity. Love it.
Yeah. I mean, what a satisfying thing to do, you know? Yeah, that's extraordinary. I think that's beautiful, Nicole. And it feels like the perfect moment to end this episode. Thank you again so much for your time. And listen, everyone, as you know, on Flip the Focus, we believe that we all rise together. So you won't have heard Nicole today quieting anyone else's voice. She's taking us all on a journey to inform, include, and inspire us about this industry where technology and humanity meet. I want to say that Flip the Focus is made possible by Hotwire Australia. And become part of the community, check out Hotwire Australia on LinkedIn, and make sure you like and subscribe to the podcast. And please do feel free to rate or review us. It's how we get found, and it keeps us telling more fantastic stories like Nicole's. So thank you so much again, Nicole, for your time, and we'll talk to you all soon.